Paul Gascoigne and Gareth Southgate are both integral to the story of Euro 96 in very different ways. They were at different parts of their career, were different kinds of players and had deeply contrasting personalities. One scored the goal that encapsulated how England fans felt during the tournament, while the other missed the penalty that sent the Three Lions out. The new issue of 442 magazine is a Euro 96 special, including in-depth profiles of both Gazza and Gaz Southgate. I'm Connor Pope, and for today's episode of the 442 podcast, we're going to be delving into these two characters, using Euro 96 as a jumping-off point to explore the two players' histories. I'm joined by Si Hawkins, who wrote the Paul Gascoigne profile, Gary Parkinson, who wrote the cover feature on the tournament, and staff writer Chris Flanagan. So Chris Flanagan has provided a wonderful question, which I'll pose now, but I'll get him to answer it at the end of today's podcast, which is, who won more caps, Paul Gascoigne or Gareth Southgate? Which I think is a brilliant question, because Southgate played in more tournaments, but Gascoigne was a staple of the side for so long that I genuinely didn't know the answer when Chris asked it. I know it now, but Chris will come to you at the end to provide the answer, leave people knowing that they have to listen to the entirety of this podcast to find that out. I want to start with you, Si. You wrote this fantastic feature on Paul Gascoigne in the magazine. Gascoigne was 29, Southgate was 25 in 1996. But how had Gascoigne's international career gone since receiving the yellow card against Germany in 1990? What happened in that kind of six-year gap?
Well, so Graham Taylor took over, obviously, after 1990. And, I mean, one of the first things he did was drop Paul Gascoigne for the Ireland game away. I think we had Ireland home and away in the Euro qualifiers. And he dropped Paul Gascoigne for Gordon Cowans, which was a bit of a national... Paul Gascoigne was everywhere at this point. Mm. Gazza mania was at its height. He was the most famous person in the country.
So was there outrage around that then?
I think I can't really remember, but yeah, no, I'm pretty sure there was. Yeah, no, I think it was one of those. Taylor wanted to put his mark on the team. Mm. He wanted to make a statement. It's a tricky job to come into. I think 1990 changed football. It changed people's perceptions of football. It got a whole lot of people into football who hadn't been into football before. I think some of the people I spoke to for this piece genuinely think that Paul Gascoigne got a whole lot more diverse range of people into football. And then Bobby Robson leaves and Graham Taylor's got to take that on. And it's quite a tough job to walk into, really. And so one of his first statements was to drop Paul Gascoigne. And
perhaps he decided that Gascoigne could not knock it. But he came back for Euro 96. Was that the absence that he'd had, not just from the England team, but from... the English football, having played for Rangers, having played for Lazio during that period, he'd not really played in England at all. Was there a more excitement around the idea that we'd be seeing Paul Gascoigne back in England at Euro 96?
In between 1990 and 96, he didn't play that much. I mean, he thinks he missed the first big injury he had in the 91 Cup final. Mm. Self-inflicted. He said he missed 21 England games from then until sort of 94 or so, when he came back and played a few more games. And then he got injured again doing a crazy tackle on someone when he was at Lazio in training. So then he missed another load of games.
Mm. Might have been a young Alessandro Nesta.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yes, it was. Yeah. But even when he did play in that period, I mean, he did actually play in both the Holland games in the qualifiers for the 94 World Cup, which I think we sort of forget. I think with Gascoigne, we sort of assume he didn't play in any games apart from those famous ones. We sort of assume he came back from injury for the 1991 for Spurs for the 91 Cup final, and they just sort of nursed him through those cup games, which I think is kind of true. And then he didn't play at all apart from these amazing games. Okay, but he did. He did actually play in both the Holland games for Graham Taylor in the 94 qualifiers, and didn't. I mean, you could put that down to Graham's tactics, perhaps. Certainly Gazza does. Even in the Norway, those two Norway games, he arguably helped motivate the opposition with his famous... Can we swear on this podcast?
Go on. I'll allow it.
Yeah, I mean, he was walking... I think it was just before the game, just before on the way to the first game, and a Norwegian journalist poked a microphone in his face and said, hey, do you have a message for the Norwegian people? And he said, fuck off, Norway. which is a brilliant way of motivating. And we got one point out of those two games. So,
yeah. You know. Wasn't there a suggestion that he might go on loan to a Norwegian team later in his career, which was met with rather short shrift?
He went. I didn't realise this, but I'm just doing the piece. It cropped up. Yeah, it's basically, I think it was 98 and he was at Middlesbrough. And he'd actually, after the 98 World Cup, he didn't get picked for that. And I think people assume his career just finished. Mm. Actually, he had quite a good season for Middlesbrough afterwards, but then injuries kicked in. And then they tried to, Brian Robson, I think it was manager, and he tried to loan him out to some Norwegian clubs. And they literally laughed at him. I mean, there was I think, some swearing going on there as well.
Now, it's obviously quite early in this episode, but I'm going to put out quite a big question, which is, Alex Ferguson called Paul Gascoigne the best player of his era. I presume he means the best English player of his era by that, but get everyone's opinion on that. Do you think he was the most talented during that period?
English, yes, absolutely, for quite a large era. He was the talisman of that team. The best moments of that era came from Gaza. He just had such a natural ability to glide past players, to create. He could do everything. You know, he could create, he could score goals. He may not have been a natural leader in terms of a natural sort of captain, conventional sort of captain, but in terms of someone who inspired that team just through his sheer force of personality and sheer ability, then absolutely. I think that's what England are missing today. You know, they've got a very good team, but do they have a central midfielder that's going to grab a game by the scruff of the neck? Maybe not quite at the moment. And that, I mean, the Gazzas don't come along very often, so you can't expect that. But yeah, certainly the current England team would be a hell of a lot better for a Gazza.
Gary, what kind of player was Gascoigne? Was he a natural number 10? What kind of role would we see him playing in the kind of modern Premier League, for instance?
The idea now would be that he's a number 10 because he's a dribbler and he's very much a touch player, and he could certainly unlock those doors, unlock those defences, pick the locks. But actually, he did a lot of running, and he was doing a lot of running right up in Euro 96, the semi-final. You know, he got to that, he very nearly got to that ball in extra time. That ball, everybody knows the one I'm talking about, that cross, he very nearly got to it in extra time. He was puffing a bit in the later stages of some of the day games, but the evening games where it was cooler. Venables didn't make a single substitution in that semi-final, which is still amazing because he could have made three. I think it was the first tournament with three subs. Didn't make any because Venables knew his first choice 11 and Gascoigne was in it. He wavered a bit. He took him off against Switzerland, I think. And he, according to Stuart McCall in this issue, he was about to take him off against Scotland. England's formation at Euro 96 was very fluid. But at heart, normally, it wasn't a back three. It was more often a back four. With it was a 4-1-3-2, I guess you'd call it, with Ince minding the shop. And the three in front of him being Gascoigne, Anderton and McManaman. Now, that's a heck of a midfield. Yeah. You know, there's basically Ince, he's going around doing all the tidying up in that midfield. But the younger lads on the wing are also getting back and getting in the way. Yeah. Allardyce used to say to JJ Okocha, you might not be able to tackle, but you can stand in the way. You know, so there was a lot of positional discipline in that midfield, even if, you know, some of them were, you know, even worse at tackling than Paul Scholes.
I think Gascoigne put the little bit of magic. I think that was the... I think that's probably... It's interesting what you're saying about we could do with it now, but I think one of the problems with England we've had over the years is that we've had this talisman. And then the trouble is, if they're not around, and I think that's what happened in the Taylor years of England.
It's funny how the talisman always seems to get injured just before the major tournament. So they're back just before... Funnily enough, it's happened again.
Right. If you think about those newspaper articles before the with Beckham and Rooney and the toe, they had the metatarsal?
Yeah, and
printing the mat to pray on and all that kind of
that's
thing.
That's right. The problem with that is that then the rest of the players are like, Okay, well, are we any good? I mean, you know, it doesn't really... I think the one good thing we have now is that in some way... I mean, we could really do with that creative midfielder, but that, that focus on one player is not always helpful.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think...
And I think Southgate recognises that as well.
It's probably more...
As a manager.
Sorry. More focused on two players now, I suppose. Certainly Kane would be a massive loss, but you've still got Sterling, I suppose. Yeah. Mm. But other good players as well, but those would certainly be still your two... key players.
Just to answer the earlier question, by the way, on whether he's the best player of his era, I think everybody loved watching Gascoigne play, but consistency is a lot of greatness.
Yeah.
Consistency is a lot of greatness, as Confucius never said, except in a bad translation. And he wasn't that consistent. There were times, even within Euro 96, where he was treading water a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not quite the same era, but Shearer's got to be mentioned as one of the best players of that era. It's easy to take him for granted because he's now, you know, the slightly narky bloke off Match of the Day.
Yeah.
But he's just scored a phenomenal number of goals for a phenomenal number of seasons.
And actually, sorry, on that point, I saw someone saying earlier on today, in fact, that the thing to remember about Shearer is that while he won the league once, he didn't actually play for a great team over a long period of time. It's Southampton, Blackburn and Newcastle. So to score 260 Premier League goals for those teams actually
and
bad.
And have two cruciate ligament injuries as
well.
Yeah,
yeah. And to change his game as he went along. Well, we're not really here to talk
about Gascoigne and whether he was the best. I mean, I think that's the thing. In 1990, he kind of, because I think leading up to 1990, we had a disastrous Euro 88 when we thought we were going to do well. And all the talk, all the zeitgeist then was all about us being behind Europe and we weren't in Europe and Tony Adams got bombed out of the team at that point. He's another one who had a sort of Damascene kind of sort of change in that tournament as well. But by the time Gascoigne got to 96, I don't think there was that much expectation about him at all. I think he'd been playing in Scotland for a few years and the English press, I should say, had that, you know, looked down on it a little bit. Yeah. So, and because of the stuff before the tournament, I think there was a lot of people, there was a poll where 88% of people didn't think he should be even in the squad, I think.
Incredible, really. Chris used the phrase sheer force of personality earlier. That is probably not a phrase that gets used a lot about Gareth Southgate. I think in the run-up to, before Euro 96, I think he only had 4 England caps. And then at the tournament, he started in all 5 games. Was there perhaps a surprise that he became so central to that team at Euro 96?
He was also nearly 26.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea is that he was a young player and an exile, but he wasn't. He was September 1970 he was born, so he was knocking on 26. And he'd played nearly 200... Knocking on 26?
Yeah, I know. Imagine.
He'd played nearly 200 games for Palace and they'd gone up and down a couple of times. I think when they went down the third time, he moved to Villa. Yeah. Who were then, you know, the establishment, but not, you know, often challenging for the title. What he represented for Venables was adaptability. I think Southgate played in 4 different positions during Euro 96. He played as left centre-back in the second half against Scotland after playing as the defensive midfielder. So at half-time, Venables took off Pearce, kept the back three, but moved Southgate back and brought on Jamie Redknapp as a sort of quarterback or passing midfielder to try and get in behind Scotland. He also played in the middle as well. You know, he moved about and Venables wanted that adaptability. He needed that adaptability. Gareth Southgate was not one of the stellar players of the nascent Premier League. He was a good fella. Just one of those slightly odd people that can play in 2 positions. He can apparently play in midfield.
He was mainly that bloke that Roy Keane stamped on that time, wasn't he?
Well, you're going to have to narrow that down.
One of the blokes that Roy Keane stamped on that time.
You know, but he was all right with the ball at his feet.
Yeah.
And then what happened after that was Rio Ferdinand came along, who was even better with the ball at his feet. But Southgate, I had a check while doing my due diligence and investigation for this. Southgate played, he started 12 of Hoddle's first 14 games after Euro 96. So Hoddle trusted him and kept him about, but then he kind of got eclipsed by Ferdinand after that.
Well, you can see how he suited a three-man central defence, which obviously Hoddle continued after that. In terms of his ability, like you said, to play in different positions across that, and also his ability on the ball was good.
And I think his specific role during the Netherlands game had been to man-mark Dennis Bergkamp, yeah. which I'm sure no one envies. But
in the middle of a back four, so it's yeah. another different role.
It's but apparently, you know, that was a great game, and someone, perhaps Bobby Robson, said that, you know, that was a world-class performance. Bobby Charlton, I think it might have been, actually. But you know, to do something like that, I'm sure, really made his name quite early on in that tournament.
He certainly settled into Venables' team and squad. Venables definitely had the players that he wanted to be his first 11. I think he only chose 12 starters during the entire tournament. And two of those, and the changes were enforced by suspensions for David Platt and then Gary Neville.
I'm sort of assuming that...
Sorry, Paul Ince and then Gary Neville. David Platt came in as the 12th starter. He wasn't one of the starting 11. Sorry, Si.
I'm sort of assuming that Southgate probably got in the squad partly because of his versatility, because I think he came through at Palace as a midfielder originally, I think. So that's always useful. I mean, squads in particular, you know, if he can play a few different positions. But, I mean, that period, that when Venables took over, they didn't, because England were hosting, we didn't have any actual competitive games. He played all sorts of people. All sorts of people have got caps.
It came together quite late, didn't it? Apparently the Swiss game was his third start. Southgate, after Bulgaria and China. China away, always a good one to blood the youngsters, or the nearly 26-year-olds. But yeah, Venables had obviously made his mind up and had got the core of it, or most of his team, but he needed somebody that could step out of defence or move around. And yeah, he was trying a few different cards, was Venables.
It's certainly mentioned in this issue about how he was influenced by Ajax. And that would fit into that total football idea of different players being able to play in different positions. I mean, that really fits that idea, doesn't it?
Well, he also benefited from Mark Wright's injury, because Mark Wright got injured. He was going to be, I think, the guy that stepped out. I mean, he probably wouldn't have played in midfield, but he would have been in there otherwise, because I think he played in the last friendly but one, Wright, and then did his knee.
Yeah, he did that in 86 as well, Mark Wright. Yeah.
That's interesting, because actually I would have ranked Mark Wright as possibly the most forgotten. If you look at those 12 starters that we've already talked about, Mark Wright, I really think, probably would have been about 13th of those. But do you know what I mean? No one now kind of remembers Mark Wright. Right? Even if Gareth Southgate hadn't become England manager, I think Southgate would have had a longer-lasting memory in English football fans' minds.
I've got a theory that if... I was asking maybe the younger people around this table. If Gareth Southgate hadn't missed that penalty, would you know that he was even in that team?
It'd certainly be... If you're talking about the one that's most likely to be a pointless answer, on pointless,
yes,
yeah, he'd be
exactly.
up there.
Yeah,
he'd be up there.
Yeah.
I mean, not knowing he missed the penalty, of course. But
it's one of those players who doesn't... You know, he doesn't stand out. That's why managers like him, because he does a steady job, and you probably don't even notice him. And a lot of fans probably wouldn't really notice him. So I think probably I can't really remember much else about.
He's the kind of player where you would have maybe you've gone, was Sol Campbell in the Euro 96 squad? Would he have played in the back with Adam?
The Honda Jazz, the car that feels fabulously small on the outside, yet deceptively big on the inside. With its incredible storage solutions and magic folding seats. Not to mention the suite of advanced safety features. And now with the small but big Jazz event, it's available with 0% APR representative and 5 years complimentary servicing until January 31st. Visit your local dealer to find out more. Honda dealers are credit brokers, not lenders. Finance provided by Honda Finance Europe, authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Kate Lawler.
And I'm Bodge.
And we're the hosts of Maybe Baby, the podcast for the parentally undecided. Speaking to the likes of Alison Hammond, Russell Kane and Jenny Eclair to give us their unfiltered view.
This week's podcast is brought to you by Aviva Life Insurance.
The fact is, if you're a parent, life insurance gives you that peace of mind at the time it's needed most. A quote could be done online in minutes and costs start at just £5 per month.
To find out more, head to aviva.co.uk.
T's and C's apply, and there is no cash in value at any time.
If you're enjoying this episode, you'll love the Euro 96 special issue of 442 magazine, which is on sale in shops and online now. In it, we've got a long read on the tournament, a diary of every single match day, reports on all the England games, interviews with players including Paul Ince, Teddy Sheringham, Darren Anderton and Carol Poborski, profiles of Paul Gascoigne and Gareth Southgate, and the full story behind Badil and Skinner's fantasy football. You can subscribe to the magazine for £12.25 every 3 months, getting issues delivered to your door for less than £4 each. That's over 100 pages of brilliant football journalism 13 times a year, including Euro 2020 and new season previews. Head to myfavouritemagazines.co.uk/FFTpod20 to subscribe now. You can also find that link in the show notes for this episode below. Now, something that we vaguely referenced already, the dentist chair. Mm-hmm. Can you talk us through that? Presumably it was on the same tour of the Far East that included the away trip to China. But what happened and how did it come about?
Well, it's quite interesting this because it's always been seen as a bit unfair on Gaza. Because there's that famous newspaper front page and he's right in the middle of it. Mm. But you know, the rest of the squad, I mean, Brian Robson was one of the coaches and he was one of the most main guys who was sort of involved early on. His shirt got ripped off pretty early. It's quite interesting because it's a bit unfair on Gaza that he gets the brunt of that. However, he basically had a fight on the plane over there, which didn't get reported, even though it got reported to the FA. And then he had a fight, and then he went around smashing up the plane on the way back. So, which did get reported, and the team took collective responsibility for. So, it was quite a fascinating. So he took all the blame for that particular incident, most of it anyway.
Whereas flip side, a tabloid fan.
Yeah,
you know, he'd accidentally created this Gaza brand. So he was the tallest poppy. So when the tabloids wanted to wage hell on the England team, he was the one, it just so happened that they got the picture of. But I think it was his birthday, though.
Yes, well, yeah, I was going to say, directly or indirectly, it was his fault because it was his birthday that sparked all this, because it was his birthday the day after, so as soon as it went to midnight, they started drinking, and that's how it happened.
And so this was a drinking session at the end of the tour, am I right? There was no more matches after that, so they got their kind of, you know, professional responsibilities out of the way.
And they'd all been auditioning, because I think it was a 27-man squad or something like that went out, or maybe 26, but they were basically auditioning. Some of them were not going to go to Euro 96. Venables probably needed a quiet night in the hotel by himself. It's all right, I'll send Brian out with him. What's the worst that can happen? Yeah. But, you know, they'd done their job. And they needed to go and
But I think the other thing is they just played like a Hong Kong select 11 or something like that in the last friendly. Yeah. Where Mike Duxbury played in it for Hong Kong. I think he was out there playing for a club at the time. Maybe a couple of other English players, I think, as well.
Been above non-league, I think.
Yeah, I think I met him over Watson in or something like that. But
Mike Duxbury was over. I went to Dubai for 4-4-2 about. God blimey, that was a long time ago. But yeah, Mike Duxbury was over there working with kids there. Mm. So he was very much sort of coaching in Asia.
So I remember speaking to him and he said, oh, well, we went out for a dinner with the Hong Kong Select 11 and the England team. And they went out for a lovely dinner together. And I said, did he go on to the nightclub after? He said, no. So the England players then went off on their own for what happened. And then, but in this Hong Kong Select 11 game, I think they'd only won 1-0. It's certainly been very, very unimpressive against a team they should have been expected to beat. People expecting to beat about 7-0 or something. So there was already like, well, this is not looking promising for the tournament. Then Dentist Chair happens straight after that. And people are thinking, well, this really isn't looking good for the tournament.
Yeah, I think the protests around the quality of that Hong Kong 11 go on to this day. At least I think that's what the Hong Kong protests are about. But in this bar, the dentist chair was the kind of the main attraction in the middle of it. And it was something, did you put your feet in stirrups or something? And then people would pour spirits into your mouth. Mm. And so that is what became the famous front page. And that is what became the famous celebration. I mean, the fact that Brian Robson was there, I think, is quite interesting, that Terry Venables possibly let him out as the serious adult, given that it was at Italia 90 where Gascoigne dropped a bed on Brian Robson's foot, I believe.
Well, yeah, there was some sort of hijinks going on, and it was, I'm seeing Gascoigne around the hotel. Just, it seems like that's his natural environment, is to be around a hotel with footballers. That's where he's happiest, because then he's got people to play with. Yeah. And then Robson was the captain of England, and I think Robson tried to tip a bed on him or something, but it was Gascoigne who sort of started the whole antics. So,
certainly it feels like, I might be wrong and I might be too young and didn't kind of see enough of him, but it feels like these tournaments brought out the best of Gascoigne on the pitch and possibly also the worst of him off it. Is that a fair analysis, or actually was he that good and that bad the rest of the time as well?
Certainly he was a man for the big stage. When those big games came around, he was ready for it. He was prepared to take that pressure, and he performed. Other things went on as well, but I suspect those other things were going on all the time with Gazza. It's just they got more widely reported when it happened near a tournament, to be honest.
Exactly that. I think what might bring out the worst of him, if you want to use that phrase, is being cooped up. Mm. I mean, his second autobiography, which I think is called Being Gazza or something, Gazza rather than My Story, that's the one, is just a fascinating, it's basically a 12-step thing about his various addictions and mental issues.
Yeah.
You know, he talks about his OCD. I don't think he mentions ADHD specifically, but he's obviously on that spectrum. Mm. I don't think that's an unfair thing to say. He used to be a very fidgety, bored child, I imagine. Italia 90, he was taking on Americans in the hotel at tennis and things like that, and you know, people couldn't believe that he couldn't. Why can't he just rest? Because he's eternally agitated.
I think, Tony Cotti told me a story recently about they're in Albania, I think it's like 88, 89 or something. And he was just in his hotel room with bars of soap, throwing them at the chickens outside. And Bobby Robson came in and said, what are you doing, Gazza? He said, I'm just throwing soap at the chickens. And Bobby knew Gazza by his way. Okay, on you go.
As long as you're not dropping an iron bed on
the
top.
He was only like two games in. That was about his third squad.
Yeah.
I think it's quite interesting. It depends who you talk to, because I personally think, from immersing myself in Gazza for a few weeks, I came out of it thinking, and speaking to a few people, and it came up a few times about how much he actually loved that. And I think him being cooped up, he always was cooped up. As soon as Gazza Mania happened, he couldn't leave the house, really, you know. So him being in a hotel, I genuinely think he, especially with 98 and what happened with 98, him smashing up the hotel room, and I think he wanted to be away with the lads in a hotel as much as he wanted to play football. Yeah. It's not so much. It's not just playing in the World Cup. He wanted to be. He'd already done almost as much as he could do in a World Cup or a tournament. I think he, you know, the idea of spending a month not being with the lads in a hotel, because as I say, he's with people who are also bored. Then, you know, and it's everyone's like he is suddenly.
I obviously everyone knew about Gazza, the character, the clown, during this period, but certainly someone who is a bit younger. Actually, it's become a lot clearer to me throughout the entire time that I've been kind of aware of him as a persona, of the darker side of his character. And like you say, the OCD, bipolar disorder, ADHD, I think bulimia is clearly something that he suffered from. He would eat a lot and then starve himself and drink only water for days. I think the press intrusion caused a grave consequence to his mental health, and also the lots of allegations of things like domestic violence. How much of that were people aware of at the time, and how much of it, you know, was it difficult because of the way the tabloids covered it, or, you know, what was seen of his darker elements?
I don't think people were particularly aware of it before 96. I think the particular incident with his wife was
just after.
It was early Glenn Hoddle's reign, and there was this awkward thing with, I mean, just incredibly awkward press conference where they actually still picked him for the squad, and they shouldn't have done. Right. And it was a PR disaster. And it's an interesting one when you're writing about Gazza, because there's so many things that now would, you know, in the current culture would get someone cancelled, as they call it. You know, it would basically, you wouldn't be able to talk to them anymore. It's amazing the affection people still have for him. And I think it's because people realise how troubled he is, and how there's no point castigating Gazza anymore. He does it himself himself. So I think, I don't think that people were aware of it particularly before 96. I think certainly after that, everything caved in on him, and I think it became all too obvious.
But he ended the tournament on a high, one of England's star players, finally back on track after injuries. Was there a big hope that this would be a new start for him and that the Gazza of old would be back?
Well, he was 29 by that point.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was no reason to think that he couldn't go to France 98, which, you know, next time we'll definitely do it, was the English clarion call. What Gascoigne had... What had happened to Gascoigne in those 2 years was that he'd found a manager who'd understood him, could fit him into a system. He started more games under Venables than under any other manager. He played more under Robson, but mainly as a sub because he couldn't fit him into the team. And as you mentioned before, I've forgotten about that Graham Taylor had preferred Gordon Cowans. Now, Sid Cowans was a good footballer. He could pass it away, but he was not Paul Gascoigne. So he'd finally found a manager. He'd found a home, basically, and it's a pity that it was England rather than a club. He was happy at Rangers, but he was also, you know, starting to go a bit off the leash, off the field as well. The hope was that, well, Glenn Hoddle should be able to fit him into a team, because Glenn Hoddle was a big misunderstood genius as well that should have won more caps. Hoddle the player and Hoddle the manager were very different. So I think there was hope. Whether there was expectation or not that Gascoigne would stay at the centre of all things England,
yeah. I think there's obviously, you know, it's still remembered widely about what happened just before 98 and him not getting in the squad in the end. And I think it's sort of, people look back on it and sort of think that, well, that seems a ridiculous decision not to take him to 98. He was Paul Gascoigne. He must have been one of the best players back then. He still had talent, but I must admit, there were friendlies directly before that squad was selected where I remember him not being very good, mm-hmm. where he gave the ball away constantly. That must have frustrated Hoddle. I think he got criticised in the press for those performances. Now, it was still probably a surprise that he didn't get in the squad at all, because he'd gone from a starter in those games to not being in. But I think Hoddle had just decided, well, I'm going to drop him from the team. Once he's not in the team...
he becomes a problem.
Exactly.
All right, a problem to manage, person management. And it was, I think, was he still playing in the second division then? I mean, the thing is that Gascoigne was playing for Rangers, who, you know, who were doing very well as a club. But as you mentioned before, the if you achieve greatness in Scotland, there's always the, well, could you do it in England thing, particularly if you're English. And then when he moved to England, it was actually to a second division club in Middlesbrough. They had big plans. They were trying to get promoted, and it's still Middlesbrough with the greatest will in the world. It's not Manchester United. It's not Tottenham Hotspur.
He just moved to Middlesbrough just before that, and I think unfortunately that made him, he was nearer to London as well, so he was easier to go out with. Started hanging out with Chris Evans, and I actually think, I mean,
well, also he was working with Brian Robson, who's the kind of guy that takes the players down the pub afterwards.
Well, that's right. Yes, that's right. I mean, Paul Merson left Middlesbrough to go to Villa. They seem to be Villa and Southgate went the other way. Seemed to be Villa and Middlesbrough used to swap players quite. And Merson went from the Gazza era Middlesbrough to Villa to get away from the drinking culture.
Right.
I think I tend to think of Gazza at 96 as a bit of a last hurrah, to be honest. And I actually think there's a bit of a parallel. In some ways, we could look at it as like there's, I mean, Gazza leaves it in triumph and Gareth finishes the tournament as a sort of pariah a little bit. But actually, I think it's quite similar, because I tend to remember at the time after Gazza's miss, perhaps England's greatest miss. I tend to remember after that, a lot of people went, oh, if he hadn't been so fat, or if he hadn't had all that booze before the tournament, and suddenly it all went full circle again. Right. Quite a lot of people were saying, actually, to be honest though, if you watch it, I mean, as you say, he's making a surging run into the box in extra time.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone forgets that bit, you know. Yeah. So people forget because he looks so cumbersome the way he actually.
I think he expects the keeper to get something on it as well, so he's kind of checking his run on purpose.
So he would have got there. Yeah. It's just he was thinking that he was going to take a touch and he'd need to check his run, like you said, to tap it in.
But you're right, there were question marks because it had kind of been, it was almost, I mean, not to get too biblical, but it was kind of the prodigal son. He had literally left and gone elsewhere not long after Italia 90. And it hadn't all been rosy for the prodigal son while he was away. But then suddenly he was back in the England team in a tournament and things were starting to go well. So it feels, I know what you mean about Alastair R. I wouldn't necessarily go that far, because there was a hope that he might be able, that Hoddle might be able to get the best out of him from where I was. But I don't think people were relying on him. And as Chris says, in the run-up to the World Cup, he was certainly not the first name on the team sheet, even if he'd been a Gareth Southgate-style dream to have around the whole town.
So Southgate, you know, Captain Sensible, obviously his tournament ends on a dreadful low, missing the penalty against Germany. What was the reaction to that? How, you know, what kind of treatment did he get and how did he deal with it?
I think he certainly got, I mean, there's always going to be idiots who, I mean, I think until we became until England got very good at missing penalties, you know, and became quite consistent at it. I think
became a big club at that point.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think we used to blame. I mean, there was quite a lot of people just blame people and not understand how you could miss a penalty and not realise how. So I think the problem. I mean, I think there was a lot of sympathy because he seemed like a nice chap. You know, he was clearly wasn't his fault. Then I think people realised how come. I mean, it was good of him to actually step up and take one before some people who perhaps should have done. That's the main.
No, I think that. I mean, I seem to remember at the time a lot of people said, "Well, why didn't Paul Ince take it and stuff like that?"
We have an answer for that in the new issue.
We
of
do
442.
We do
available. In all good news.
But it wasn't like Beckham in 98. I mean, Beckham, when he got sent off in 98, people really went for him.
Yeah.
But obviously that's an instinctive reaction, but a deliberate action that got him sent off. Whereas Southgate, everyone understood he's trying to score that penalty.
Yeah.
It's slightly different. But.
Yeah, when we talk about vilification, I mean, really, there's an element of immediately after the event, but then there's the season after. And the season after Italia 90, every ground that Forrest went to, Pierce was getting pelters. Every ground that, every time Chris Waddle was seen in public, he was getting pelters. David Beckham. But there's a thing about that in that the players that you hate on the opposition team when you're on the terrace are the hard guy and the guy that's going to hurt you. Mm-hmm. You know, now Pierce was the hard guy, but Waddle was a very good player. Beckham was a very good player. Ince, you know, was the hard guy. Batty, also from 98. So you would boo those players. Booing Gareth Southgate seemed a bit off. It seemed a bit unfair. I mean, even on the terrace, it was like you'd give him a bit of jip, maybe, but you wouldn't necessarily really hound every single touch.
He still seems to have that childlike quality. Like he kept saying that he was nearly 26 at the time, but he looked so young, and the way he carried himself seemed to be of a very young man in that squad.
Something very English and unassuming about
He certainly didn't have the kind of like force about him that you would think this guy's going to be fine if we give him grief.
I mean, that said, while I was researching it, he spoke to 442 in 2012 and said, "It affected me massively afterwards, and it still does. Every single day it's mentioned." You know, so we say he wasn't as vilified, but I mean, I imagine it was mentioned more than once every day to David Beckham, although he was behind.
But the headline of the feature about him in this magazine is, "Why didn't you just belt it?" Which is a quote from his own mum.
It's fair enough, though. I mean, obviously this magazine has a
fair enough. Well,
I'm with his mum.
It's fair enough us saying that because it's a Euro 96 themed magazine. Whereas I think actually the nice thing about having a second act like he's having is that now actually if someone comes up to him in the street, they probably won't mention that. They'll mention
the waistcoat.
Although it's interesting though, like even like last with the World Cup, like everyone's waiting for a penalty shootout, so we could all talk about how he's missed that penalty there, but now it's redemption. And he was like, even when it's redemption, like, can we just stop talking about Euro 96 and that bit? Because like Paul Ince says in this magazine, because Ince went through the same thing on a slightly reduced scale, but with missing the penalty against Argentina in 98, that even success, he could win the Euros this year. And one, people will talk about, "Oh, this is redemption for Euro 96. And he'll be like, "Can we just forget that last bit? Just think about this tournament." But even if he wins this tournament, it won't, or at least Paul Ince thinks that it won't be redemption for Euro 96. Euro 96 will always hurt, sadly, because it's a separate experience. And if he wins this tournament, that would be a great experience, but not related to Euro 96 for him, because no matter what he does, he could win 18 World Cups. And Euro 96 would still hurt.
Well, I mean, to reach for too grand or horrific a comparison, but the Americans will always talk about Pearl Harbor, despite the fact that they basically won the war single-handed.
Unless he puts himself in the squad and then scores the winning penalty.
Possibly. I mean, it's worth a try.
I think you've slightly kind of answered this question a little bit, but finally, I just kind of want to ask all of you whether you think that Euro 96 was a defining tournament for both players, and in their footballing careers, rather than obviously anything that has come afterwards?
I think not. as much as I should be drumming up enthusiasm for these this issue of the magazine. When I think of Gascoigne, although I think of Euro 96, I think of Italia 90 and the hope and excitement that is generated by any young player. I mean, he wasn't very young, but any young player that starts to make the work, their story is yet to be written. Euro 96, as Sally said before, Euro 96 was a bit of a last hurrah. It was a good summer for him. But when I think of Gascoigne, I think of him crying.
Yeah, I agree
and
with
I
that.
Think I think of the unfulfilled promise, and I think of him as a deeply flawed and you know as a human who I hope gets better. I hope gets help. That's what I think of now. When I think of his football career, I think of Italia 90. For Southgate, I now think of the World Cup. I think that has eclipsed Euro 96 and one fluffed penalty.
That's interesting, though, in that I think for the comparing the two tournaments, that image of Gazza crying is the bigger tragedy for him, even though England didn't go on to get to that final. And it's interesting what you say about never being able to properly redeem yourself for the penalty miss, that actually it's the tragedy that really does kind of...
Yeah, well, I slightly disagree with Gary on in terms of which tournament most defines them. And well, I agree on Gascoigne. I do think the first image that comes to my mind is the tears in 90. Certainly 96 and the goal against Scotland is a very, very close second.
Yeah.
But for Southgate, I think, like I say, unless he wins a tournament, and even maybe then, the first thing I'll always think of is that penalty in 96. So as sad as that is for him, it was such an iconic moment.
I think, as players, I think the two defining moments of their international careers certainly are those two moments. The goal, Gazza's goal against Scotland. I mean, because the crying, even though it was... Yeah, I mean, the first image, if you see a video of him or something, you know, something, that'll be the picture. But I think with him, that's not him. He's not playing. That's not a playing moment. I think the actual moment of action, because in Italia 90, he set up a lot of goals and did quite a lot of stuff, amazing lot of stuff that actually he was England's best player. But that one defining moment of magic, I think, in his whole career, perhaps, is that goal. It's interesting actually looking at those two tournaments, because it's quite interesting stuff came up in doing the piece for this issue about how the impact that Gazza had on everything. In terms of, we were talking about how certainly I think Alison Rudd I spoke to, who wasn't even a big Gazza fan actually, didn't think he was all that, but thought that certainly a lot more women got into football because it was this apex of people started, everyone's got on board with this tournament and started watching it, who hadn't really watched football because it had such a bad image beforehand.
The middle classes.
Yeah, basically. And then his tears at the end of it just solidified
I think never underestimate the power of seeing someone cry on television. Mm. Andy Murray won three sports personalities, and part of that, obviously mainly down to Wimbledon, winning Wimbledon, but also his popularity turned right around on crying at Wimbledon after the loss. Yeah. And I think it's the same with Gazza.
It's interesting the other way around now. What also came up was that the celebration after the Scotland goal, which we all love, and certainly I think we all love now, but actually at the time there was so much sort of lads culture going on, and it wasn't, a lot of people weren't on board with that, and it wasn't universally popular. It seemed almost like two separate things. On one hand, he's showing this side of modern masculinity in 1990, the new man thing, and then suddenly in 1996 he's lying on his back and getting beer poured in,
with bleached hair as well.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting mix. So the image of Gazza is quite fascinating. I mean, it's changed over the... Changed quite a bit over those two tournaments. And now the image of him is completely different compared to that joyful figure we look at as a player. It's the difference between those two characters. Mm. Whereas Southgate, I think you see the line from player through. I mean, I think Southgate as a manager, you can sort of see that perhaps football has changed to meet him. I think perhaps 10 years ago, it wouldn't have... You look at him at Middlesbrough, he seemed too nice. Whereas nowadays, players need a pat on the shoulder rather than a hand around the shoulder, pat on the back, that's it, rather than to kick up the...
It's easy to think actually that he, and with the problems that he had, came a bit too early, and actually had it been 20 years later, possibly due to characters like him in the public eye so much that people are much more willing to talk openly about these kind of issues and alcoholism and depression that he clearly suffered from, and it is the kind of great tragedy of him. But finally, Chris, we're going to come back to the question I asked at the beginning, yes. which is who won more England caps, Paul Gascoigne or Gareth Southgate?
So the answer, Gareth Southgate, 57 caps. Paul Gascoigne, 57 caps.
Oh, I know that. Cliffhanger ending. Who will get to 58 first? Find out. Gary, Chris, Si, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks to Si, Gary and Chris for joining me today. Don't forget you can subscribe to the magazine now at myfavouritemagazines.co.uk/FFTpod20. And the Euro 96 special is in shops now. The music you've heard is from Hal Griff, featuring none other than Gary Parkinson. And like this podcast, it's available on iTunes and Spotify. Thanks for listening.
Stay warm for a while, 18 degrees on Saturday. Cooler though as we head through the week across all areas. Have a good afternoon.
What's this? It's all right, Daddy's here. Come on. What's this?
You might be surprised to know that you can get de facto five-star life insurance from Aviva from just £5 a month. Yep, thought so.
Don't put it off. Get a life insurance quote today. Direct at aviva.co.uk.